This is Audible.
Dedicated to all the victims of socialism, past, present, and future. As Margaret Thatcher famously said, the problem with socialism and socialists is they always run out of other people's money. Chapter 1. The Problem with Socialism. A quarter of a century after the spectacular collapse of socialism in the Soviet Empire, a large segment of the millennial generation of young Americans, those born between 1982 and 2004, thinks socialism may be the wave of their future. A 2015 YouGov.com poll revealed that 43% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 had a favorable opinion of socialism, and that they have a higher opinion of socialism than they do of capitalism. Who says the public schools are not teaching the kids much these days? A 2016 Pew Foundation poll found that 69% of voters under the age of 30 expressed a willingness to vote for a socialist president of the United States, and literally millions of millennials voted for self-described democratic socialist Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party primaries in 2016. Sanders won majorities of the under-30 vote in several major state primaries, campaigning on a platform of free higher education, free health care, and a vastly increased welfare state. "Did America forget what socialist means?" asked one pundit in response to this youthful fascination with neo-Marxism. Apparently so. Just as apparent is the fact that many younger Americans believe that there is a Santa Claus after all, stripped of all his religious significance as St. Nicholas, of course, who can and should give them free education, free health care, free whatever they want, because they deserve it. But government is not Santa Claus, and nothing is free. Uncle Sam has not been replaced by Uncle Santa. Someone has to pay for all those doctors, nurses, hospitals, medicines, x-ray machines, ambulances, and everything else associated with health care. The public schools are not free either. They are paid for with billions of dollars in property taxes and other taxes imposed by federal, state, and local governments. The same goes for free higher education that is occasionally promised by political demagogues like Senator Sanders. What socialists like Senator Sanders should say, if they want to be truthful and straightforward, is not that government can offer citizens anything for free, but that they want health care and much else to become a government-run monopoly financed entirely with taxes. Taxes hide but do not eliminate the cost of individual government programs. No one gets an itemized tax bill denoting how much goes for national defense, how much for the Department of Labor, how much for the Environmental Protection Agency, how much for celebrating lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Pride Month, established by President Obama in June 2009, and all the rest. Consequently, it is indeed difficult to know exactly how much of one's taxes goes for any particular program. But nothing about government is ever free. According to the Tax Foundation, working Americans toil, on average, until the end of April each year, one-third of the year, just to pay all the taxes owed to federal, state, and local governments. After that, they can begin working for themselves and their families. Does anyone really believe that turning any industry into a tax-financed, Department of Motor Vehicles-style government-run monopoly, which is what socialism is, will make things cheaper or free, instead of substantially more expensive? History and all worldly experience would suggest that the latter is true, and that socialism, government-run monopolies for healthcare or anything else, reduces the quality of products and services offered to the public. What we must forget. In order to have a favorable view of socialism, one must have either forgotten what the entire world learned about socialism from the late 19th century on, or have never learned anything about it in the first place. The latter is obviously true of much of the younger generation. Socialism started out being defined as government ownership of the means of production, which is why the government of the Soviet Union confiscated all businesses, factories, and farms, murdering millions of dissenters and resistors in the process. It is also why socialist political parties in Europe, once in power, nationalized as many of the major industries, steel, automobiles, coal mines, electricity, telephone services, as they could. The Labour Party in post-World War II Great Britain would be an example of this. All of this was done ostensibly in the name of pursuing material equality. In the foreword to the 1976 edition of his famous book, The Road to Serfdom, Nobel laureate economist Friedrich Hayek wrote that the definition of socialism evolved in the 20th century to mean income redistribution in pursuit of equality, not through government ownership of the means of production, but through the institutions of the welfare state and the progressive income tax. The means may have changed, but the ostensible end, equality, remained the same. Hayek's mentor, fellow Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises, explained in his classic treatise, Socialism, an Economic and Sociological Analysis, that the welfare state, the progressive income tax, and especially pervasive government regulation of business were all tools of destructionism in the eyes of the socialists of his day. That is, he observed that the proponents of socialism always employed a two-pronged approach. One, the government takeover of as many industries and as much land as possible, and two, attempts to destroy existing capitalist societies with onerous taxes, regulations, the welfare state, inflation, or whatever they thought could get the job done. We must forget or be oblivious to an awful lot of not-so-ancient history to have a favorable view of socialism. We must be unaware of how it is a form of economic poison that destroys prosperity and is the biggest generator of poverty the world has ever known. In the early 20th century, it turned Ukraine from the breadbasket of Europe to a desolate, barren land where the people could hardly feed themselves, let alone export food to anyone else, in just a few years. It had the same effect all throughout the world in countries that adopted socialized agriculture. When the Chilean government adopted socialism in the early 1970s and nationalized industries and farms, the economy ground to a halt and the government did what all socialist governments eventually do to bail themselves out. It printed massive amounts of money to attempt to keep the economy, which it had all but destroyed, going. The result was that the cost of living rose by 746%, the annual inflation rate. Unemployment was sky high, and the government was eventually replaced in a coup by a repressive regime. The Soviet economy was so dysfunctional, thanks to 70 years of socialism, that by the time the entire system collapsed in the late 1980s, it was most probably only about 5% of the size of the U.S. economy, according to Dr. Yuri Motsev, an American economics professor who was an advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union. This was despite the Soviet Union's vast natural resources, unrivaled by any other country or political empire. Soviet socialism never produced a single product that succeeded in international competition, with the possible exception of Russian caviar, which comes from a fish, the sturgeon, not a factory. All of the socialist satellite countries of the Soviet Union suffered a similar economic fate, from Romania, Czechoslovakia, and East Germany to Cuba and beyond. In socialist country after socialist country, the common people were equal in their poverty, while the political elite lived privileged lives. The entire world celebrated the demise of Soviet socialism. But nowhere was the celebration as great as among the millions of surviving victims of socialism who lived under the boot of the Soviet Empire. Great Britain adopted its brand of democratic socialism known as Fabian socialism after World War II as it nationalized many key industries, imposed very high rates of taxation, established a massive welfare state, and adopted socialized medicine and government-funded pensions. Britain had been the wealthiest country in the world up to the beginning of World War I, so it was able to live off of the capital created by previous generations of British entrepreneurs for a while. But within 20 years, the entire world was talking about the British disease, a phrase that was used to describe the gross inefficiency of all those socialist, government-run monopolies in the British steel, automobile, telephone, electric, and other industries. By the 1970s, the British had had enough. After 30 years of Fabian socialism, they elected Margaret Thatcher prime minister. A student of Friedrich Hayek and other free market economists, she privatized many of Britain's nationalized industries. For decades, Great Britain had been falling behind other European democracies in terms of per capita income. That trend was reversed by Thatcher's desocialization programs. Another example of an economic catastrophe caused by the adoption of democratic socialism is the country of Argentina, which embraced socialism in the late 1940s during the Juan Perón regime. Perón restricted international trade, imposed wage and price controls, seized private property, nationalized some industries, and spent lavishly, much of which was financed by the government simply printing more money. The predictable result was economic ruination and hyperinflation that led to Perón's ouster in 1955 by military coup. Argentina, however, remained socialist. Its economy continued to stagnate, and several coups later, by the late 1980s, it was suffering from 12,000% inflation from years of trying to cover up the failures of socialism by printing money to pay for all the socialist programs. In 2001, Argentina defaulted on its obligations to foreign lenders in the then largest public default in history. It defaulted again in 2014. Argentina was once the world's 10th largest economy, but by 2016 it was barely ahead of Kazakhstan and Equatorial Guinea. India was once one of the wealthiest countries on earth. Its textile industry was the envy of the world. It had sophisticated financial markets, many talented entrepreneurs, millions of acres of fertile farmland, and plenty of extravagant wealth. When it gained independence from Britain in 1947, it was no longer one of the richest nations on earth, but it inherited an infrastructure of railroads and schools and ports and parliamentary institutions and law, and the lingua franca of English. Unfortunately, in rebellion against the traditions of its capitalist imperialist masters, but in accord with intellectual fashion, it adopted a homegrown version of Soviet-style central economic planning. Under Prime Minister Nehru and his top economic planning minister, Prasanta Chandra Mahalanobis, India adopted a series of five-year plans modeled after the notoriously failed Soviet five-year plans. The Marxist economic model that was used to justify these plans was one that was first developed by a Soviet economist named G. A. Feldman. It eventually came to be known as the Feldman-Mahalanobis model for a socialist, centrally planned economy. It was no more successful in India than it was in the Soviet Union, as India, after independence, became synonymous with poverty. In the 1980s, Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi essentially gave up on socialism and cut taxes and deregulated and privatized industries. The result was that India's economy finally became revitalized and started to create wider prosperity. Economist George Aite, a professor at American University and native of Ghana, is the author of several scholarly books about how socialism destroyed the economies of many post-colonial African countries that rejected capitalism and adopted socialism in the 1960s. African leaders took the position that Soviet-style socialism, with the state determining the economic destiny of the people, was the best way to move Africa toward economic prosperity. Many foreign companies were nationalized and numerous state-owned enterprises were established. Roadblocks and passbook systems were employed to control the movement of Africans. Marketing boards and export regulations were tightened to fleece the cash crop producers. Price controls were imposed on farmers and merchants. Bewildering arrays of restrictions were imposed on imports. Capital transfers, industry, wages, trade unions, prices, rents, interest rates, and the like. Only socialism will save Africa was the slogan of African political elites. The result was that, 40 years later, these African countries were poorer than they had been as colonies. The African political elites, however, were fabulously wealthy, with billions of dollars stolen from public treasuries and bribery a necessary condition to get anything done. Socialism is as alien to Africa as it is to the rest of the world, wrote Professor Aite, who recounts the long history of private property and entrepreneurship among Africans before the alien ideology of socialism was imposed after independence. Nobody can defend socialism on the basis of the African tradition, he concluded. For most of the Cold War years, the starkest difference between a capitalist and a socialist economy was the comparison of communist China with nearby Hong Kong. Hong Kong was one of the freest economies in the world under British rule, with a modest, flat income tax and very little government regulation of business. That recipe made Hong Kong, with no natural resources to speak of except for a large harbor, one of the most prosperous countries on earth. By contrast, socialist China experienced the usual economic stagnation and backwardness that is the hallmark of all socialist economies. China abruptly liberalized a large part of its economy beginning in the late 1970s by allowing private enterprises and even private banks to some extent to exist. The creation of a free enterprise segment of the Chinese economy, combined with a typical Chinese Confucian work ethic and entrepreneurial spirit that is on display all over the world, began to produce prosperity. By the beginning of the 21st century, China had become one of the biggest, if not the biggest, manufacturing economies in the world. A little bit of desocialization can go a very long way in terms of creating prosperity and eliminating poverty in previously socialist countries. China has a long way to go, but its people have benefited greatly from these first steps away from socialism. What also must be forgotten if one is to have a favorable opinion of socialism is that government control of an economy, whether done in the name of equality, environmentalism, or anything else, has long been associated with the destruction of civil liberties, especially freedom of speech. Government planners throughout the world are intolerant of public criticisms of their grandiose plans. In some socialist countries, like the former Soviet Union, criticizing the government led to imprisonment or worse. In less totalitarian socialist states, criticisms are censored or outlawed. As one student of socialist societies put it, a key trait of socialism is a profound opposition to personal liberty and scorn for individual reason, a complete contempt for the individual. They unceasingly attempt to mutilate, to curtail, to obstruct personal freedom in any and all ways. This book will serve as a primer on socialism and capitalism for some, a historical reminder for others, and a handy sourcebook on all the problems of socialism and how it threatens a free society. Along the way, we will examine how egalitarianism is at war with human nature, why so many of the worst people have risen to power under socialism, why fascism is just another form of socialism, how the success of Scandinavian socialism is a myth, how the welfare state and the progressive income tax actually exacerbate inequality, why pollution and other environmental problems are far worse under socialism, why minimum wage laws, government-run school monopolies, and socialized financial markets fail, and why more socialism inevitably means less freedom. What follows is the truth about socialism and what it will mean if it becomes our future. Chapter 2, Why Socialism is Always and Everywhere an Economic Disaster. Socialism in all its forms has always been poisonous to economic growth and prosperity. This is not because the wrong people have been in charge of socialist regimes, and that better or smarter people could somehow make socialism work, or that all that is missing is democracy. Socialism is economic poison for several fundamental, inherent reasons. In other words, it is impossible for socialism to be anything but impoverishing as an economic system because of the very nature of socialism. Every imaginable type of socialism was tried in the 19th and 20th centuries, producing nothing but economic stagnation or much worse. Some post-colonial African countries, like Zimbabwe, went from being economic breadbaskets to economic hellholes. But everywhere, from Britain, India and Latin America to Africa, socialism brought economic ruin. Worse, in the Soviet Union, China, North Korea, and Cambodia, it manufactured not just poverty, but mass executions numbering in the millions and the most tyrannical regimes in human history. At a minimum, socialism has what economists would categorize as an incentive problem, a knowledge problem, and an economic calculation problem. A good example of the incentive problem involves the first American pilgrims. How socialism almost destroyed America. The first American settlers originally adopted communal or socialized ownership of land and property. As a result, most of them rather quickly starved to death or died of disease. When the first pilgrims arrived in Jamestown, Virginia, in May 1607, they found incredibly fertile soil and plentiful seafood, wild game, and fruits of all kinds. Despite all of this, within 6 months, all but 38 of the original 104 Jamestown settlers were dead, having starved. 2 years later, 500 more pilgrims arrived in Virginia, transported there by the Virginia Company, and a shocking 440 of them died from starvation or disease. This became known as the starving time, described by one eyewitness. So great was our famine that a savage we slew and buried, the poorer sort took him up again and ate him, and so did divers one another, boiled and stewed with roots and herbs. This man also remarked that the cause of the starvation was want of providence and industry, and not the barrenness and defect of the country, as is generally supposed. In other words, the problem was lack of effort, not a lack of resources. The essential problem was that all of the pilgrims were indentured servants who had no financial stake in the fruits of their own labor. All that they produced went into a common pool to be used to generate profits for the Virginia Company as compensation for transporting them to America and to support the colony. Working harder, longer, or smarter produced no additional benefit to anyone because the system that was set up was essentially agricultural socialism, and everyone was compensated the same regardless of individual effort. The absence of property rights in the land and of any link between effort and reward destroyed the work ethic of the pilgrims, just as it always does in any socialist society, whether that of the Jamestown pilgrims or that of the former Soviet Union. Historian Philip A. Bruce wrote of the Jamestown pilgrims that the men idled over their tasks or refused to work altogether, and men who were known to be young and energetic by nature were derelict. In 1611, the British government sent Sir Thomas Dale to serve as the High Marshal of the Virginia colony. Dale noted that the surviving settlers were healthy and spent much of their time playing games and other vigorous activities. He immediately identified the source of the colony's problem as the system of socialized land ownership. Consequently, he determined that each man would be given 3 acres of private land from which he was only required to pay a tax of 2.5 barrels of corn to the Virginia Company. Everything else was his to keep or sell. The Jamestown pilgrims then began to prosper. Each man realized that by loafing or shirking, he was paying the full cost of such behavior in the form of lost profits. At the same time, everyone realized that increased effort led to increased rewards. As historian Matthew Page Andrews wrote, as soon as the settlers were thrown upon their own resources and each free man had acquired the right of owning property, the colonists quickly developed what became the distinguishing characteristic of Americans, an aptitude for all kinds of craftsmanship, coupled with an innate genius for experimentation and invention. The private property system that replaced agricultural socialism in the Jamestown colony was quickly expanded so that each settler who paid his own way was given 50 acres of land, and by 1623 all land had been converted to private ownership. Capitalism replaced socialism, and the pilgrims thrived. The same tragic mistake of adopting agricultural socialism was made in the Massachusetts colony, where about half of the original pilgrims who landed in Cape Cod in 1620 were dead within a few months. Fortunately, the leader of the Mayflower expedition, William Bradford, recognized the problem. For the young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong or man of parts had no more division of victuals and clothes than he that was weak and not able to do a quarter the other could. This was thought injustice. And for men's wives to be commanded to do service for other men, as dressing their meat, washing their clothes, etc., they deemed it a kind of slavery. Neither could many husbands brook it. Socialism was the root cause of the starving pilgrims in the original Massachusetts colony. Bradford recognized this and, like his Virginia predecessors, decided to abandon agricultural socialism and allow private property ownership. In his own words, it was decided that the Pilgrims of Massachusetts should set corn for every man for his own particular, and in that regard trust to themselves, in all other things, to go on in the general way as before, and so assigned to every family a parcel of land for present use, and ranged all boys and youth under some family. This had very good success, for it made all hands very industrious, so as much more corn was planted. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to set corn, which before would allege weakness and inability. By 1650, privately owned farms were as predominant in Massachusetts as they were in Virginia and elsewhere in the colonies, and the American economy began to thrive and prosper. The institutions of private property and free markets led to a burst of entrepreneurship and wealth creation. By 1776, the young American economy was 100 times larger than it was in the 1630s, and Americans had already become among the most affluent people in the world. As has been proven hundreds of times in world history, whenever socialism is applied, economic disaster, even to the point of starvation, follows. As the economist Murray Rothbard wrote, by the early 20th century, everyone, socialists and non-socialists alike, had long realized that socialism suffered from an incentive problem. If, for example, everyone under socialism were to receive an equal income, or, in another variant, everyone was supposed to produce according to his ability, but receive according to his needs, then, to sum it up in the famous question, who, under socialism, will take out the garbage? That is, what will be the incentive to do the grubby jobs, and furthermore, to do them well? Or to put it another way, what would be the incentive to work hard and be productive at any job? 150 years of experiments with socialism in dozens of countries, large and small, proved the truthfulness of Rothbard's admonition. Russia was the world's largest exporter of grain before adopting socialism in 1917. Because of socialized agriculture, as many as 10 million Russians died of starvation in the 1920s and 1930s. When Mao Zedong socialized Chinese agriculture, as many as 30 million Chinese starved to death between 1959 and 1962. Socialism produced horrifying human disasters in Cambodia, Ghana, Ethiopia, Tanzania, and other countries during the 20th century. The exact same kinds of results occurred in manufacturing and all other industries under 20th century socialism. For, as economist David Osterfeld wrote, socialism by its very nature rewards sloth and indolence and penalizes diligence and hard work. It therefore establishes incentives that are incompatible with its self-proclaimed goal of material prosperity. The inherent dilemma of socialism is that individuals who respond rationally to the incentives confronting them will produce results that are irrational for the community as a whole. In the early 20th century, some socialists argued that socialism would somehow rather magically transform human beings, effectively taking the place of God to create a new socialist man who would no longer be acquisitive and interested in pursuing his own self-interest. This was long ago proven to be a farce, as it never occurred anywhere on Earth, despite the use of terror and mass murder by the former Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and other socialist regimes in vain attempts to prove their theory to be correct. The knowledge problem. A second reason for the inherent and inescapable failures of socialism as an economic system is known in the economics profession as the knowledge problem. This problem is associated with the writings of the Nobel Prize-winning economist Friedrich Hayek, who first explained the idea in a 1945 academic journal article entitled "The Use of Knowledge in Society." In that article, Hayek explained that the kind of knowledge that makes the economic world go round is not just scientific knowledge, but the detailed and idiosyncratic knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place that the millions of people who make up the world economy possess and utilize to perform their unique jobs and live their lives. No government planner could possibly possess, let alone efficiently utilize, such vast knowledge. For example, consider something as simple as a slice of pizza. What would it take to make a pizza from scratch? Well, the first ingredient would be dough, which would require a wheat farm to raise the wheat that is turned into flour, which in turn is turned into pizza dough. The wheat farm requires all of the engineering know-how that is used to build all of the tractors and other farm equipment, farm tools, fertilizers, irrigation systems, and whatnot. Then there is the grain storage business and all that goes into it, along with the trucking industry that is used to transport the grain. The transportation industry requires gasoline or diesel fuel, which means the petroleum industry must become involved, including all of the sophisticated engineering knowledge that is used to extract petroleum from the earth or the ocean floor and refine it into gasoline. So far, considering just one ingredient of a common pizza, dough, we learn that it requires the efforts of probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people from all over the world, all with very specialized knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place that they use to do their jobs. Then there is the tomato sauce, which requires a tomato farm and all the farm equipment, tools, fertilizers, irrigation, transportation, and so forth, that is involved in growing and marketing tomatoes. A dairy farm is then needed to produce milk, which is turned into cheese for the pizza, and on and on. The lesson here is that what makes the economic world, indeed human civilization itself as we know it, possible, is the international division of labor and knowledge in which we all specialize in something in the marketplace, earn money doing it, and use that money to buy things from other specialists. All of this occurs spontaneously without any government planner consciously dictating how to make pizzas, how many to make, or where pizza parlors should be located. As Adam Smith explained in his famous 1776 treatise, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, what motivates people to put forth all of this effort and cooperate with each other to give us our meat and our bread is not their selflessness or their love of their fellow man, but their concern for their own well-being. By pursuing their own self-interest in the free market, they coincidentally, as though led by an invisible hand, benefit the rest of society as well. As for socialism, it is worth repeating that no government planner or group of government planners with the most powerful computers available could conceivably possess and utilize all of the constantly changing information that is needed to produce even the most common and simple consumer goods, let alone sophisticated products like automobiles and computers. The false notion that government planners under socialism could possess and make better use of all this information than the myriad consumers, workers, entrepreneurs, business managers, and other market participants in thousands of different industries was labeled the pretense of knowledge by Hayek in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1975. It was, said Hayek, the fatal conceit of socialists everywhere. Hayek also pointed out how the free market pricing system is indispensable as a tool of any functioning economy. Government-mandated prices, such as we have in socialist economies, produce nothing but chaos. In a market economy, prices are like road signs. In this case, they reflect the relative scarcity of goods and services, the intensity of consumer demand, and help us order our economic lives. When a product or service becomes more scarce, consumers look for alternatives, which is one engine of innovation. When prices rise, investors are alerted to consumer demand and look to provide consumers with what they want at a lower price or to improve on the existing product or service. Without market prices, rational economic decision-making is impossible, which is another core reason for the failures of socialism to produce anything but poverty, misery, and economic chaos. The calculation problem. The most devastating critique of socialism is known as the calculation problem. Economist Ludwig von Mises explained it in his 1920 treatise, Socialism, an Economic and Sociological Analysis, and in his later 1949 treatise, Human Action. Socialists who advocate government planning with government ownership of the means of production face an impossible task, said Mises, because they have no idea how to go about arranging the production of goods and services without real, market-based capital markets, such as the stock market, private banking system, and so on. It is capitalist entrepreneurs, Mises wrote, the professional speculators, promoters, investors, and lenders, who all have a personal financial stake in the investments they make, who allocate capital in a market economy. Their indispensable tool is market prices, which guide them to invest in a rational, profitable way, meeting consumer demand. Under socialism, where government owns all the means of production and capital markets are non-existent, and resources are allocated by bureaucrats to meet plans that might have no basis in economic reality. In a capitalist economy, entrepreneurs have to meet consumer demand or go bankrupt. This doesn't mean that capitalist markets are perfect, only that there is an enormously powerful incentive for private investors to invest their money in ways that will be rewarded by consumers. This incentive, however, is totally absent from a socialist economy, where it is not consumer demand and the investor's desire to make a profit and avoid a loss, but government direction that allocates economic resources, which is why Mises deemed socialism to be impossible as a viable economic system. It simply makes no economic sense. Some 70 years after Ludwig von Mises first explained the impossibility of rational economic calculation under socialism, the well-known socialist economist Robert Heilbronner authored a momentous essay in The New Yorker entitled "The Triumph of Capitalism," in which he begrudgingly admitted that Mises was right about socialism all along. At the time, the 70-year-old Heilbronner was the Norman Thomas Professor of Economics at the New School for Social Research, and had spent the previous 30 years of his academic career advocating and defending socialism. Norman Thomas was a 20th-century presidential candidate of the American Socialist Party. The point here is to note the irony of the renewed popularity of socialism today, especially among a segment of the college student population, when even longtime 20th-century defenders of socialism, such as Robert Heilbronner, finally admitted that it was a massively failed and misconceived idea. To be a modern-day advocate of socialism is to completely ignore all sound economic logic, more than a century of history, and the words of honest socialist intellectuals like Heilbronner, who were finally forced to confront reality after ignoring it for most of their adult lives. Chapter 3. Egalitarianism versus Human Reality. The pervasive rallying cry of socialists is equality. Capitalism creates too many inequities, they say. But they ignore the fact that all human beings are unique, and inequality is thus inevitable. The relentless socialist crusade for equality is not just a revolt against reality, it is nothing less than a recipe for the destruction of normal human society, as the Russian and Chinese socialists of the 20th century, among others, proved. In the name of socialist equality, they destroyed their economies, condemned hundreds of millions to poverty, and executed millions of dissenters. And even after all that, they never created anything remotely like an egalitarian society. Democratic socialist countries that have not gone to these murderous extremes have nevertheless been content to live off of the capital accumulated from limited or previous free markets in their countries. Socialists are less concerned about equality before the law or equal rights to liberty than they are with material equality, which of necessity has to be forced upon society by the state. Rabbi Daniel Lappin, a clergyman who is also an economic writer and speaker, points out that anything made by God, whether it be human or stones, which can range from small pebbles to glittering diamonds of infinite variety, is unique, while things made by man, like bricks, can be made uniform. The essence of the socialist enterprise is to use the coercive powers of government to turn us all into identical bricks. The desire to turn unique human beings into identical socialist bricks explains why socialist regimes are often totalitarian, because it is the only way they can make a serious attempt to achieve their aims. The socialist obsession with equality has always been at war with the division of labor and knowledge that comes naturally in a market or capitalist economy. Ludwig von Mises noted that the fundamental social phenomenon is the division of labor and its counterpart, human cooperation, which in turn is what leads to economic progress and development. The uniqueness of every human being, our differing physical abilities, mental abilities, and interests, different aptitudes, preferences ad infinitum, mean that we naturally tend to specialize in something, to focus on what we do best. In a market economy, this allows us to specialize in what we do best and get paid for it, and then trade with other specialists for the goods and services we desire. An obvious consequence of this is that a capitalist economy creates an interconnected community that constantly strives to supply all of us with the best goods and services at the lowest price. It provides employment for people of all imaginable talents and abilities. It blows past subsistence economies, where one individual or family or village has to do everything itself. It creates wealth, which can support charity, and it encourages international trade because not only are human beings unique, but so are their material and geographical resources. No government program, for instance, can ever change the fact that Saudi Arabia is a vast desert with huge supplies of oil, or that the American Midwest contains millions of acres of some of the most fertile farmland on earth. The Saudis specialize in oil and sell it to Americans. Americans specialize in agriculture and sell food to the Saudis, whose irrigation systems, as sophisticated as they are, still render agricultural production several times more expensive than what can be achieved by American farmers. The international division of labor, as much as a domestic division of labor, results in everyone becoming more prosperous. Another point is that the division of labor and knowledge has always spawned a different kind of human cooperation in the form of teamwork, for many tasks cannot be performed by single individuals. Hence, people tend to become specialists not only in some skill or trade, but also as members of a team that produces goods and services. The division of labor and the pursuit of profit encourage human cooperation. In a market economy, people are paid and businesses earn profits, or incur losses, strictly according to how good a job they do in meeting consumer demand. A good definition of capitalism in this regard would be, "Give me that which I want, and I will give you that which you want." Inequalities of income are inevitable because of competition. Some businesses and entrepreneurs do better than others. The key point, though, is that the market is fluid. Businesses can change or improve. Workers can find more profitable enterprises or better ways to apply their skills. To socialists, it is not just generic inequality that is wrong and has to be eliminated by government. There is also the so-called iron law of oligarchy. This is the insight that in every organization or activity, a few people will typically emerge as the leaders or top producers. Thomas Jefferson called this the phenomenon of a natural aristocracy. We see it with elite athletes in professional sports, top-of-the-chart musicians and entertainers, Fortune 500 companies, lists of the top 100 doctors, lawyers or schools, and so forth. In a market economy, such elite individuals and institutions can demand higher wages or tuitions or whatever than the average. To most of us, there is nothing wrong with this. But socialists and sometimes mere bureaucrats often think differently. The great H.L. Mencken noted that all governments, not just explicitly socialist ones, are enemies of the most energetic, productive, and motivated. In his words, "All government, in its essence, is a conspiracy against the superior man. Its one permanent object is to oppress him and cripple him. If it be aristocratic in organization, then it seeks to protect the man who is superior only in law against the man who is superior in fact. If it be democratic, then it seeks to protect the man who is inferior in every way against both. One of its primary functions is to regiment men by force, to make them as much alike as possible and as dependent upon one another as possible, to search out and combat originality among men. All it can see in an original idea is potential change, and hence an invasion of its prerogatives. The most dangerous man to any government is the man who is able to think things out for himself without regard to the prevailing superstitions and taboos. This is because government justifies itself by regulations, and regulations seek to impose uniformity and government control. Almost every government intervention in the economic sphere is, in reality, an attack on the natural division of labor and knowledge, the glue that holds human civilization together in favor of a bureaucratic diktat. Every minimum wage, maximum hour law, progressive income tax, welfare state program, labor regulation, employment quota, tax on dividend income, special corporation income tax, and on, whittles away at the societal benefits of the division of labor in the forever failing attempts to use governmental force to achieve the holy grail of material equality. Karl Marx, the most famous of socialism's founding fathers, harshly condemned the division of labor and the inequality it produced, and sought to eliminate it precisely in order to destroy existing societies so that they could be replaced by presumed communist utopias. Marx and Marxian socialists sought and seek to use the coercive powers of government to stamp out all human differences, differences that Marx himself called a contradiction of the socialist ideal. In Marx's own words, an ideal communist society is one where nobody has one exclusive sphere of activity, but each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes. Society regulates the general production and thus makes it possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow. To hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming a hunter, fisherman, shepherd, or critic. Your author once asked a class of undergraduate economic students what they thought of this passage. A young man who was born and raised in Taiwan in the shadow of communist China blurted out, "Only a child could believe such a thing." This idea of Marx's and of many other prominent socialists is the basis for the idea of communes where everyone is supposedly equal. Such thinking is occasionally on display in the academic world, such as when a Marxian-minded segment of the Harvard faculty traded jobs for a day with a janitorial staff. Socialist icon Leon Trotsky predicted that once socialism had destroyed the division of labor, man will become incomparably stronger, wiser, finer, his body more harmonious, his movements more rhythmical, his voice more musical. The human average will rise to the level of an Aristotle, a Goethe, a Marx. Only a child or infantile-minded adult could believe such a thing. One thing that fuels the socialist mindset, indeed the thing that defines one as a socialist, is the overriding importance of envy, one of the seven deadly sins. Ludwig von Mises catalogued several reasons for socialists' compulsive envy in his book, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality. First, there is the fact that so many people refuse to accept the reality that those who accumulate wealth in a capitalist society do so simply by pleasing large numbers of their fellow citizens with the products or services that they sell. In terms of making money, Mises wrote, "The movie star outstrips the philosopher." This often creates a lifelong feeling of envy and hatred towards capitalism and capitalists in the mind of the philosopher. Many people also insist that they should be judged by some kind of absolute standard, defined by the government, of course, as opposed to the dollar votes of their fellow citizens. Consequently, they are frustrated and envious of the more successful among them. The less successful, including the lazy or incompetent, often express hate and enmity against all those who superseded them, wrote Mises. Political demagogues take advantage of such people by promising them something for nothing, free health care, free education, free you name it, in the name of egalitarianism. Some people face up to, deal with, and improve upon their inadequacies, while others search for scapegoats. Perhaps the most popular scapegoats of all are greedy capitalists, who are often accused of doing well financially by some nefarious, unscrupulous, or illegal means. There are, of course, people like this, but it is not a general characteristic of markets. There are sinners in all walks of life, not just the business world, and in a market economy, as opposed to a socialist government monopoly economy, where bribes are often a fact of life, no one wants to do business with dishonest people, so the market penalizes the cheaters, and products with bad reputations don't get purchased. Moreover, to preserve the integrity of markets, a market-friendly society always has laws against fraud. But envy is a powerful emotion, and so is fear, even among the wealthy and successful. Mises offered an intriguing analysis of why so many in the entertainment industry, for instance, are egalitarian socialists. Entertainers, he noted, serve consumers whose tastes can be capricious and unaccountable. Consequently, many actors, directors, and movie producers are rich and famous one morning and may be forgotten the next day. This inherent instability of fame and fortune is what makes so many in the entertainment industry so critical of capitalism and so embracing of socialism, even though it is the freedom of capitalism that makes them rich and famous in the first place. A similar phenomenon exists in the literary world, where trash novels outsell serious works of nonfiction by many orders of magnitude. The tycoon of the book market is the author of fiction for the masses, Mises observed. This breeds resentment among intellectuals who write nonfiction books that languish on university library shelves. They tend to blame this inequity on the unfairness of capitalism. But it is not inequity and unfairness that are at the root of socialist envy. It is a desire to stamp out diversity, to enforce uniformity, to order society and the economy on rationalist lines as designated by allegedly smarter-than-thou bureaucrats. The result, as history has shown, is often tyranny of an almost unimaginable ferocity. Numerous writers have understood this and written about it, sometimes very entertainingly. For example, in Facial Justice, the British fiction writer L.P. Hartley wrote of an imaginary utopia where envy is institutionalized by a government program that makes sure that all female faces are equal, performing coerced surgery to detract from the more beautiful and uplift the less attractive until facial justice is finally realized. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. wrote the short story Harrison Bergeron, depicting a comprehensively egalitarian utopia. The year was 2081, and everyone was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal in every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anyone else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anyone else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. The handicapping worked as follows. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. Egalitarianism has been lampooned in horror fiction, wrote economist Murray Rothbard, because when the implications of such a world are fully spelled out, we recognize that such a world and such attempts are profoundly anti-human. Being anti-human in the deepest sense, the egalitarian goal is therefore evil, and any attempts in the direction of such a goal must be considered as evil as well. Chapter 4. Islands of Socialism, The Follies of Government Enterprise. There are degrees of socialism just as there are degrees of capitalism. Even the Soviet Union was not 100% socialist because it permitted a small percentage of farmland to be privately owned. The Russian communists understood that without private property in agriculture, they could never produce enough food to feed their population. There were also pervasive black markets or an underground economy in the Soviet Union, small islands of capitalism that allowed many to live above subsistence levels. Today, every democratic country has islands of socialism in a sea of capitalism. Government-run enterprises like the U.S. Postal Service, state and local government public works departments, police, firefighters, garbage collection, schools, electric, natural gas and water utilities, transportation services, financial institutions like Fannie Mae, and dozens more. Indeed, many functions that are routinely performed by private businesses are also done by government-run enterprises. Decades of research in economics and simple experience show that government-run enterprises are, as a rule, vastly more inefficient and offer products or services of far worse quality than private businesses. Economists have a bureaucratic rule of two, which holds that the per-unit cost of a government service will be on average twice as high as a comparable service offered in the competitive private sector. In a free market economy, businesses that do a good job of giving the people what they want at competitive prices are rewarded with profits. If they fail at that task, they are penalized with losses or bankruptcy. This is known as the survivor principle. Businesses that fail to satisfy enough customers will not survive. No such mechanism exists in government enterprises, for there are no profit and loss statements. In an accounting sense, there are only budgets. In the private sector, profits reveal what value a business has contributed to the economy or to society. For instance, if a business takes $10,000 worth of resources and creates products for which people pay $100,000, then it has created $90,000 worth of value to society. Government enterprises, by contrast, can actually destroy value by using resources in a less than efficient or profitable way. Indeed, in government, the worse a government agency performs, the more money it can claim from a legislature, city council, or county commission. If state-run schools fail to educate children, then obviously they need more money, even if government-run schools often already spend several times more per student than private schools do. If the welfare state fails to reduce or actually increases poverty, then obviously, say the bureaucrats, we need to expand welfare programs even further. The Obama administration actually bragged about expanding food stamp rolls and claimed they were good for the economy. The socialist enterprises of federal, state, and local governments are paid for by taxpayer subsidies. Failure to pay taxes or to pay less than what the government demands leads to heavy fines, government confiscation of property, and/or imprisonment. In the private sector, by contrast, there is no forcible payment, and businessmen investing in their own businesses have to create and market products and services that consumers want and will buy of their own free will, which also means at a reasonable price. Government bureaucrats at best monopolize services that were once provided by the private sector and, in doing so, increase the cost and reduce the quality. Often they do worse than that, creating taxpayer-financed boondoggles for which there was never any real consumer demand in the first place, but mere bureaucratic whim. All of this is why the words bureaucrat and bureaucratic have taken on such negative connotations. No one likes to be called a bureaucrat, but that is what government employees are, with the well-earned reputation of having all the efficiency of the post office and all the compassion of the IRS. We are told that when government provides a service, it is free, but of course nothing is free, because someone has to pay all the government employees, their overhead, and everything else that government does, buys, or appropriates. That someone is, of course, the taxpayers. Whenever socialist-minded politicians speak of free services, what they really mean is that the cost of the service will be hidden in taxes. Unfortunately, hiding costs this way often works, at least for politicians, who can claim to have delivered services, but to the detriment of the public that is supposed to be served. When people are fooled into thinking something is free, they tend to want more of it. The result is shortages, overcrowding, and rationing. You often hear about healthcare being rationed in socialist healthcare systems, but rationing can also be seen in situations like the periodic droughts in California. Droughts, of course, are a natural phenomenon, but governments often make them worse when government bureaucrats set water prices and allocate water usage. In 2015, California Governor Jerry Brown ordered city and county governments to enforce a reduction in water usage by 25%. Failure to do so would result in a $10,000 per day fine. This comes from a state that during the concurrent drought pumped several million acre-feet of fresh water into the ocean in pursuit of government-mandated environmental goals. Politicians sometimes try to reassure a skeptical public by saying that a state-controlled enterprise will be run on a business-like basis. But no government function can ever be run like a real business because there is no profit and loss. Unlike private businesses, government enterprises supported by the taxpayers can last for generations, providing shoddy services at extremely high costs. More than that, their tax dollar subsidies and government regulation can help them cripple or eliminate private sector competition, which is one reason why the government has so many monopolies or near monopolies. It doesn't matter if your own kids go to a private school, you still have to pay taxes for the public schools and for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, government-run utilities, and everything else government does. Bureaucrats do not advance in their careers through entrepreneurship, innovation, improving quality, and lowering costs. Their success is based, as economist Murray Rothbard pointed out, on political skills, The free market promotes and rewards the skills of production and voluntary cooperation. Government enterprise promotes the skills of mass coercion and bureaucratic submission. With its access to the taxpayer's purse and, at the federal level, its printing press known as the Fed, government is able to pay its employees significantly more than comparable private sector employees. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, state and local government employees earn 35% higher wages and 69% greater benefits than private industry employees. In addition, they typically have far better job security as well. Civil service regulations and the power of public employee unions make it difficult, if not virtually impossible in some states, to fire public employees. Even during the Great Recession of 2008, in many states, private sector employment plummeted while government employment expanded. Government thus provides perverse incentives for workers to leave the productive, wealth-creating private sector for the wealth-absorbing, taxpayer-funded public sector. Cost-maximizing government enterprises. To be competitive, private companies have to minimize costs and continually innovate, creating new and better products. In this way, they maximize profits, and higher profits mean higher salaries, promotions, and success. Government bureaucrats don't deal with profits, they deal with budgets, and the goal is to expand the budget. Even if a government enterprise is managed by purely well-meaning, ethical bureaucrats, it still needs a bigger budget to do more good. Every government bureaucrat is therefore a relentless lobbyist for higher taxes and more money for his or her government agency. He is, in other words, an inveterate cost maximizer. The fact that most government enterprises have little or no competition means that they also suffer from managerial laziness and ineptitude compared to private businesses that face competition. Government agencies are notorious not only for wild spending binges at the end of every budget year, in order to justify more funding, and for overstaffing, a great way to spend money year after year, but for promoting incompetent government employees to another agency or division in a different location because of the near impossibility of firing them. If you've ever wondered why many government agencies have warehouses full of spare furniture, or why there are always 12 road repairmen standing around while 4 others are working, or why so many teachers grumble about the extraordinary number of overpaid school administrators, this is why. In government, waste and inefficiency is good, failure is success, and incompetence is rewarded. For politicians, taxpayer-funded programs are benefits and ways of buying votes. Likewise, expanding the number of taxpayer-funded federal, state, and local employees is a form of patronage. Politicians who support public employee unions get public employee votes and union funding. But the general public would be a lot better off, materially and otherwise, if government shrank and more people lived not off of the taxpayer's dime, but off of their own efforts to create better products and services that people will actually pay for of their own free will. That's how real economic and human progress is made. Chapter 5. Why the Worst Rise to the Top Under Socialism. Perhaps the defining characteristic of socialism is the governmental imposition of one plan for all of society. Socialism is nothing if it is not planning. This is not to say that socialism introduces the idea of planning into society. Every human being plans his way through life, day in and day out. We all plan our family lives, our work days, our education, our career paths, our children's future. Socialism is the forceful substitution of governmental plans for individual plans. Hence, it does not really matter if it is imposed on a society by a majority-rule democracy or a totalitarian dictatorship. In either case, everyone in society is subjected to the coercive forces of the state in enforcing its plans for the whole society. Obamacare will have the same effect on American society whether it was imposed by democratic politics or by a dictator. In his classic book, The Road to Serfdom, Friedrich Hayek explained that because collectivism of all kinds, including socialism, necessarily involves the coerced imposition of some governmental plan or plans on the population, such a system attracts as its political leaders some of the most immoral and unethical people in society. For, once the governmental plans are in place and begin to fail, as they inevitably will because of all the inherent economic weaknesses of socialism that we've already touched on, then the democratic statesman who sets out to plan economic life will soon be confronted with the alternative of either assuming dictatorial powers or abandoning his plans and admitting failure. He would soon have to choose between disregard of ordinary morals and failure. It is for this reason that the unscrupulous and uninhibited are likely to be more successful in a socialist society seeking to impose government planning of more and more aspects of its citizens' lives. Those with the least qualms about depriving their fellow citizens of their civil liberties, or even brutalizing and abusing them, will rise to the top of such a society. This was, in fact, the history of 20th century socialism all around the world. Socialism, wrote Hayek, inevitably led to the suppression of democratic institutions and the movement toward a more dictatorial or totalitarian government. Democratic socialism is, then, something of a non sequitur. Socialists might be elected democratically, but their entire government program relies on government displacing the authority of individuals or families or private institutions or even constitutional restrictions on government power. A significant movement in this direction has already taken place in the United States with the expansion of federal executive powers, the proliferation of executive orders by presidents, and the creation of dozens of presidentially appointed czars to plan and regulate everything from air travel to energy to weapons of mass destruction. How appropriate that these largely unaccountable presidential appointees, the czars, with immense regulatory powers, are named after the notoriously repressive and authoritarian Russian monarchy that was, of course, displaced by the even more totalitarian communists. Because of the inevitable failure of socialist bureaucrats to plan an economy and a society better than the millions of individuals comprising the society can, there will be dissatisfaction with the slow and cumbersome course of democratic procedure which makes action for action's sake the goal, wrote Hayek. It is then the man or the party who seems strong and resolute enough to get things done who exercises the greatest appeal to the public. The public demands a strong man or strong woman who can get things done, even if it means the abandonment of democracy. Writing in 1943, Hayek was obviously referring to the National Socialist strongman Adolf Hitler, but there have been many other examples, especially in Latin America. Once such a leader is empowered, he will want to surround himself with a group which is prepared voluntarily to submit to that totalitarian discipline which they are to impose by force on the rest. The history of socialism in the 20th century, Hayek reminded his readers, demonstrated that only the ruthless, ready to disregard the barriers of accepted morals, could execute the socialist program of pervasive governmental planning. Moreover, the socialist regime is likely to be populated by the worst elements of any society, warned Hayek. Political demagogues, and socialists are always demagogues, have long understood that it is easier for the masses to agree on a negative program, a hatred of an enemy or the envy of the better off, than on any positive program. In Bolshevik Russia, it was the capitalists and monarchists and Christians and independent farmers and aristocrats who were the enemy, and against whom the masses could be swayed, and against whom violence could be inflicted in the name of the people. In the Europe of Hayek's day, it was the plutocrat and the Jew who became the enemy. In Germany and Austria, the Jew had come to be regarded as the representative of capitalism, and hence became the target of extreme hatred. In America, political demagogues target Wall Street and the wealthy 1% as the objects of their hatred. Hatred and violence, especially for the young, is justified in the name of idealism, however perversely understood. To a socialist, the ends justify the means, which is the reverse of traditional morality, and can justify any action desired by a socialist. To a socialist, said Hayek, there is nothing which the consistent collectivist must not be prepared to do if it serves the good of the whole. This socialist mindset accepts, if not celebrates, intolerance and brutal suppression of dissent and the complete disregard of the life and happiness of the individual. Because the selfish individual does not matter, the socialist will argue that what he does is for the good of the whole. In a socialist society, said Hayek, the only power worth having is political power, and to consolidate that political power, government relies on propaganda, intimidation, and government domestic spying to discredit, bully, and eliminate possible opposition. Socialism can lead to the end of truth, as Hayek called it, because socialists believe in indoctrinating people into the truth. This is why socialist regimes have made us familiar with re-education camps and rigid totalitarian ideological conformity. Socialists believe that there are no legitimate alternative viewpoints. Socialist propaganda must dominate the educational system and the mass media so that, in Hayek's words, a pseudo-scientific theory becomes part of the official creed, which directs everybody's actions. Under socialism, every act of the government must become sacrosanct, while minority opinions, or even majority opinions at odds with the official ideology, must be silenced and are demonized. This all sounds like a perfect definition of the political correctness that plagues American colleges and universities, and which has gone a long way toward destroying academic freedom both for students and professors. Truth in a socialist society is not something to be debated. It is mandated and enforced by the socialist regime, from which there is no alternative and no appeal. Once socialist ideology takes over and respect for actual truth is destroyed, wrote Hayek, then all morals are assaulted because all morality is based on respect for the truth. The worst of the worst under socialism. To young people, the Cold War seems like ancient history, and they are increasingly unaware that communist regimes deliberately killed tens of millions of their own citizens. These are not war deaths, but deliberate acts of mass murder of civilians by their own governments. These crimes were catalogued in The Black Book of Communism, edited by several French intellectuals and published by Harvard University Press in English in 1999. Their summary statistics include the following death counts. USSR, 20 million deaths. China, 60 million deaths. Vietnam, 1 million deaths. North Korea, 2 million deaths. Cambodia, 2 million deaths. Eastern Europe, 1 million deaths. Latin America, 150,000 deaths. Africa, 1.7 million deaths. Afghanistan, 1.5 million deaths. The total estimated number of people murdered by socialist regimes in the 20th century is nearly 100 million. Among the techniques employed by socialist regimes were firing squads, hanging, drowning, battering, gassing, poisoning, or car accidents, destruction of the population by starvation through man-made famine, the withholding of food, or both, deportation, through which death can occur in transit, or through forced labor, exhaustion, illness, hunger, cold. The Soviet Union's experiment with socialism included what these authors call its venture into planned, logical, and politically correct mass slaughter. Although fascism will be discussed in the next chapter, it is worth pointing out here that fascism was a type of socialism. The Nazis called themselves National Socialists to distinguish themselves from their fellow socialists in Russia, who labeled themselves International Socialists. The German National Socialists of the early 20th century murdered approximately 21 million men, women, handicapped, aged, sick, prisoners of war, forced laborers, camp inmates, critics, homosexuals, Jews, Slavs, Serbs, Czechs, Italians, Poles, Frenchmen, Ukrainians. Among them were 1 million children under 18 years of age, according to sociologist R.J. Rummel, who spent his entire academic career documenting democide, or death by government. Socialist ideology and absolute power are the critical variables in Soviet democide, wrote Rummel. They explain how individual communists could beat, torture, and murder by the hundreds and sleep well at night. Grim tasks, to be sure, but after all, they were working for the greater good, he wrote sarcastically, echoing Hayek. Russia's international socialists were very egalitarian in their mass murdering of any and all who might be suspected of having doubts about the glories of their socialist nirvana. As Rummel explained, some of the socialist victims were from the wrong class, bourgeoisie, landowners, aristocrats, kulaks. Some were from the wrong nation or race, Ukrainians, Black Sea Greeks, Kalmyks, Volga Germans. Some were from the wrong political faction, Trotskyites, Mensheviks, social revolutionaries. Some were just their sons and daughters, wives and husbands, or mothers and fathers. And some were in lands occupied by the Red Army, Balts, Germans, Poles, Hungarians, Romanians. Then some were simply in the way of social progress, like the mass of peasants or religious believers. And some were eliminated because of their potential opposition, such as writers, teachers, churchmen, or the military high command. The Soviet government actually had a system of quotas handed down to its functionaries and henchmen. Rummel quotes Vladimir Petrov, a Soviet spy who defected in the 1950s, who revealed a written order once given to him saying, "You are charged with the task of exterminating 10,000 enemies of the people. Report results by signal." When the Soviets weren't committing acts of mass murder, they were involved in the sadistic torture of those suspected of being potential political dissenters. One Polish citizen who was imprisoned by the Soviets wrote in his memoir of how he was beaten with a hard rubber truncheon, whipped, had his hair torn, endured cigarette burns, had his fingers burned, was deprived of sleep for 9 days, and worse. Torture and murder were the foundations of government power in the socialist Soviet Empire. Things were even worse in Mao's China. The Chinese communists killed 3 times the number of people killed by the Soviet Union, and again, these were China's own people, the eggs that allegedly had to be broken to make the communist omelet. How remarkable it is that to this day, self-proclaimed socialists in academe claim to occupy the moral high ground, the ideology that is associated with the worst crimes, the greatest mass slaughters, the most totalitarian regimes ever, is allegedly more compassionate than the free market capitalism that has lifted more people from poverty, created more wealth, provided more opportunities for human development, and supported human freedom more than any other economic system in the history of the world. Socialism has not yet reached a critical stage in the United States, but the more a society moves in the direction of socialism, the more it relies on the coercive powers of the state. As such coercion becomes justified, it tends to expand at the expense of individual freedom and individual conscience. Government plans replace individual plans. The government claims a greater share of private wealth to distribute money as it sees fit. Ideological propaganda becomes more pervasive from government institutions, especially in the schools. And the economy becomes progressively more lethargic, increasingly strangled by governmental edicts, regulations, and bureaucrats. Government becomes more and more a government of the worst, by the worst, and for the worst. That's what socialism delivers. Chapter 6. The Socialist Roots of Fascism.